Yeah. Broadcasting, not live, from the far eastern regions of the so-called United States. It's the Soulcast with your host, me, Tim Holland, aka Soul. Today's guest is Will Bonzel. This is a crazy interview. Anybody growing food, anybody out there who is a vegan, this podcast is super inspiring. Will Bonzel is a very unique, interesting, and just awesome dude. He lives probably about an hour and a half from me in a little further north in Maine. And he is what I would call like a vegan homesteader. He is growing all his own staple crops, vegetarian food, and living off the land, and doing it with a practice that he calls veganic farming, which is a take on permaculture that removes animals from the environment and focuses more on growing staple crops as opposed to the more experimental, crazy perennial stuff. He still grows a fair amount of perennial experimental crops and tree crops and things like that, but most of his focus is on vegetable growing. And when I talk about being vegan and collapse and, you know, living off the land, people always say, like, you know, vegans can't do it. And this guy is proof that you can. You can live off your own land and not have to eat animal products. His book, which I read and it really inspired me, is called Will Bonzel's Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening, and it's out on Chelsea Green Publishing. Aside from, all that stuff, this guy is just really an interesting dude. Former miner, geologist, musician. It's also just inspiring to see the way he's reinvented himself multiple times through his life. One of the things I love about this book is, like, aside from just talking about how to grow plants and, like, what his ideas on it are, but it's written in a funny way, in a fun, engaging way. But he also, like, has, like, really practical things like, oh, you've got wheat. Here's what you do with it. Here's how you turn it to flour. Here's how you process these fruits. Here's how you do this. And so it's like a nice all-in-one glimpse into this dude's approach. So love this interview. Check it out. Check out Will's work. And, give us a shout on social media if you dig it. Or pop me an email, soul@soulone.org. And other than that, if you dig this podcast, share it around, rate it and review it on whatever platforms you listen to. And if you want to support this podcast financially, just a couple bucks a month, you can join our Patreon. There's a ton of benefits over there. Go to patreon.com/SOLEONE. And before we get into the interview, let's hear from some homies in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
I'm going to make those pompous academics regret kicking out such a genius. Deciding to build my lab and do my research.
The Time Talks Podcast.
Have you ever stared at a 500-page book and wish you could just talk to the author about their ideas instead? If so, the Time Talks Podcast, part of the Channel Zero Network, is for you, where we discuss history, politics, music, and art with an anti-authoritarian and anarchist perspective.
The Time Talks Podcast.
What's this light? I feel different.
The Time Talks Podcast.
All right, Will Bonzel, welcome to the Soulcast.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm pumped to have you on. I've been really geeking out over the Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening over the last couple months. And, it's an incredible book. Thank you for writing it.
Thank you very much.
So how are you doing today? How's life?
Well, generally very well. I'm going to deal with a few crises this morning, but I think I'm on top of them and getting ready to forge forward.
Nice. It's, what is it? It's the first week of April. It's, yep. The snow, has the snow melted up there yet, or?
By no means. There's a few bare streets, but Molly, we've got a foot and a half or whatever of snow in my fields right now. It's kind of crusty and wet and giving away, but not yet.
So what is your farming practice consist of right now?
Very little right now. I'm just getting ready starting some very early things, onions, leeks, and soon peppers and tomatoes, stuff like that. But still trying to catch up on writing projects and indoor projects from the wintertime, trying to tease out one last little bit I can before we do have bare ground.
Nice. So what, are you working on a new book or something?
Well, actually, I am. I'm working on a sequel to my first novel, not the one you're talking about, but an eco novel that I did several years ago, and I was planning on a sequel to it, and the sequel is now maybe 95%, 99% done, and I'm trying to wrap that up also, get that out of the way before spring comes. And I've got also some other articles and book things I'm working on. So, yeah, I'm very, very busy with writing.
That's incredible. You know, Ursula Le Guin recently passed, and
I didn't know that.
Did you? So she gave this incredible speech about the importance of, like, you know, speculative fiction and science fiction, and she was talking about, like, how, you know, dark times are ahead, and we don't need more realists. We need realists of a greater reality, you know, the dreamers to help us.
Well, believe it or not, I've never actually read anything by her. I read maybe a chapter of one of her books, and that's all. But her premises, her some people call this that genre future fantasy, and what she's called speculative fiction. That's exactly what I'm into. It's kind of amazing that I haven't read everything of hers. But in fact, during most of the many years that I was writing Through the Eyes of a Stranger, I consciously avoided reading much of that stuff until I was done. I didn't want to be overly influenced by what someone else had written. But now it's been written for quite a while, and I'm almost on a sequel, and I still haven't written much of that genre. It's kind of strange. You'd think I'd be a big reader of it.
Well, you know, it's good to, you know, trust the process. So what? Obviously, I wanted to talk about the farming stuff, but I also wanted to ask you about your fiction work. I mean, if you want to, since that's what you're working on, can you talk about this future world that you've book is about?
Yeah, very happy to, because in some ways, even though theoretically it's fiction, in some ways it's almost a companion volume to my the one you're talking about, Will Bonsall's Essential Guide to Blah Blah Blah. That one is a how-to. The other one, even though it's speculative, it still looks into the same premises of what is a sustainable, not just sustainable agriculture, what is a sustainable civilization. And one of the points that I make in the Yarrow Tales, the Through the Eyes of a Stranger, is Hesperia, the mythic civilization or whatever that is the premise of this story, is not a utopia, far from it. It is a society with plenty of warts, but it is sustainable. And my point is that a society which is sustainable, whatever things it does wrong, it has a chance to get it right and screw up and get it right again and keep trying, failing, because that's basically what evolution is. Sustainability allows evolution to keep going, and evolution should make sustainability keep going. If you have a society which, however nice it may be, but is not sustainable, then it is doomed. Whatever accomplishes it makes are going to be ephemeral, because the underlying basis for the civilization must be sustainable, and obviously I'm referencing our present situation. We are not sustainable, and because of it, we are, unless we change course radically and quickly, we are indeed doomed.
Do you think capitalism is the big culprit in there?
Not necessarily. In my fiction and in my nonfiction, I tend to lay a lot of blame at the marketplace, at our particular type of economic system, which is completely based on the market. We assume that's the only way it's done. There are many societies where there is no marketplace per se, and yet economic activity happens. I blame a lot on it, but it is not intrinsically bad any more than capitalism or any of these systems, isms. I don't think it depends on how we do it. The underlying mythic vision, I call it, the underlying assumptions, big, broad assumptions we make about it, and the moral underpinnings of it, determine more than anything else how a system works or doesn't work. Just for example, I think it's in a book by, I think it's Thorsten Veblen's, one of his books talks about how the market economy, free enterprise capital system. It's self-regulating in a very wonderful way. There's some good things about it, you know, things, you know, supply and demand and all that kind of stuff. It is in some ways an incredibly practical system, but on the other hand, it is not an inherently moral system. It's amoral. It doesn't guarantee that things will be done equitably. And so, therefore, that marketplace, any marketplace, has to be governed and regulated by things which make it work. And I guess I submit that capitalism or socialism or any kind of political or economic system can possibly work. I don't think there's intrinsic success or failure necessarily to any of these systems.
So when you're like, you know, I mean, I haven't read the fantasy books. But it's like, so are you like, when you're going through your day-to-day life with all of this, like, I don't know what I would call homesteading, you would too. And is that how you envision like what the future looks like, is people having to produce their own food and stuff like that?
Yeah. So what we're having to do here to even have this conversation, we're kind of having to reference the Yarrow Tales book. And so without your or most of your listeners probably having read it, I would point out a couple of features about the Society of Hesperia. And one thing is they have a group of laws called the Vine Laws. And the whole origin of that is all very arcane and stuff. We don't even need to know it necessarily. But a subset of the Vine Laws is something that are called the Staples Rule, which basically mandates a high level of self-reliance for two main things, staple foods and domestic energy. Now, in this case, at the stead level, which is to say the household level, the communal local level, there's other things that are mandated at a larger level, let's say the county level, the state level. It's not practical for every single household to make their own typewriters and to make their own toilet paper and so forth. But nevertheless, we're not just talking about food now, we're talking about everything, including defense and education and culture and so on, that a society should be, to whatever degree sustainable, self-reliant for these things. The more we rely on any, particularly a critical thing. It's one thing if our cinnamon comes from some other society, some other bioregion or something. But if our staple grain, for example, is not being grown here, then we're vulnerable. We're not very sustainable. We're not observing the Vine Laws.
Well, we're definitely not observing the Vine Laws today. I don't know. I'm sure you saw this news about all the flooding in the breadbasket where the corn and grain is produced. And because that production isn't spread out, we're probably going to be looking at potentially some, if not this year, you know, the idea of shortages of corn and grain, you know, it might be coming home.
This is where the stuff really starts hitting home. For many years, you know, we've been talking about things in sort of almost rhetorical respects, but we're getting with climate change in particular, but also with political instability and other here and elsewhere. We're seeing that for a long time, long before the flooding and stuff was happening, there were shortages of grain globally that were causing particularly suffering in the places where the grain was grown, whether it's Africa or India or whatever, but also forcing the price up globally and making these things less sustainable for us. I mean, we were less assured of them. And now that it's really coming home, as you say, things like in the Midwest, they're talking about the price of almonds is going to soar because of the fires and the drought and stuff in the West. And I know avocados, for example, which the global capital of production for avocados is the little town of Bonsall, California, or at least that's where the main packing distribution center is. You might wonder how I happen to know that, even though no relationship at all. What I'm hearing that farmers in that area, avocado growers, are going out of avocados, which are a tropical perennial totally dependent on irrigation. And with this drying out of the West, the avocado grapes are increasingly getting rid of the avocados and planting olives. And so that may make a decrease in the price of olives, but what's it going to do to and now, of course, with the president talking about threatening to shut down the Mexican border, an awful lot of our avocados are from Mexico. So granted, avocados are not a staple in our diet for most of us, but almost everything, winter vegetables, vegetables, period, fruits and nuts, in addition, especially the corn and legumes and stuff. These are not something. We don't know which way this is going to go. The grain could end up not being the major thing. Right now it looks like it. Any number of these things could become at risk. So, yes, it would behoove us here in Maine or in the Northeast or whatever to cast about for other sources of these things, and the first thing we should be looking at is ourselves. Ourselves individually, our own homesteads, if we are homesteaders, or at least our community supporting local agriculture, regional self-reliance. Those are the things we need to pay a really serious focus on. The game is over. It's no longer a matter of just, wouldn't it be nice? Is if we want to have sustainable, secure futures, if we don't want to starve to death, if we want to have any kind of security in our lives, we've got to be dealing with it right now. It's late to be starting even.
Yeah, as far as like, wouldn't it be nice? It's really like the end. I often say, or I've heard others say, and I repeat it, that, you know, the apocalypse isn't some far-off thing. We're living through it right now. So
it's so ironic. I know the other day I had some, time to time you have the Jehovah's Witnesses coming to the door with their things and talking about the end of the world and so on. And I find it very ironic because their forecast, this supposedly biblical forecast, is in so many ways coming true, not the way they expected it. They're not dealing with the real apocalypse is indeed coming, is here. And the solution, I believe, is not Jesus coming back in clouds of glory and everyone being saved and so on. It is dealing with the very things that are creating this apocalypse in the first place, lack of sustainability and lack of treating our environment as if it mattered.
So, well, this is a great segue into your book. I feel like, you know, me personally, like I just moved out to Maine from Denver, bought a farmhouse. I'm like, you know, I was like really into this idea of just doing a food forest. And then halfway through when I was like planning it, I started reading your book and I realized, you know, it's great to eat all these like perennial trees and stuff, but like so many staple crops that can and should be grown. In your book, you just make it really fun and interesting to grow peas and beans. So, and the other thing about it is that people are always saying like, oh, you know, when the shit hits the fan, you're going to have to go eat fish and you're not going to be able to be vegan anymore because you can't be a vegan living off the land. And so, what do you have to say to that? To people who say you can't?
You're pointing to some very good directions, and I very much want to go there. For example, the permaculture movement, with a capital P, tends to be very anti-vegan. They're very obsessed with animals and, you know, growing permacrops and feeding to animals. And the thing that disturbs me about that, although there is a sort of sub-movement within permaculture, like permaculture with a small P, that doesn't look at it that way, but the very biggest rationale, the very biggest justification for permaculture is this idea that we're always talking about, is you don't disturb the soil, you don't move a lot of stuff around for fertility and so on, you basically do a little pruning here and there and planting and mulching and so on. Very relatively much less invasive and can be enormously productive. A lot of these tree and shrub crops can do very well compared to row crops. But one of the problems, but on the other hand, I think when you take those foods and put them through an animal other than a human, you basically lose 90% of the food energy in that. This is a general thing that ecologists have found out with every time you go to a different trophic level, when you go from, you know, the algae to the tuna fish, to the plankton, you know, the thing that eats the algae, and then the thing, by the time you get to the third or fourth level consumer, like a tuna fish, you're using an awful lot of world resource, a lot of, you know, fertility, water, space, everything to create that. And so basically what the capital P permaculturists are essentially throwing away the huge advantage of their system. And if that were all that could be done, then we might say, well, okay, so be it. Still, we still want to do it. Fortunately, one of the problems with the crops, then you're kind of alluding to what we said before, is an awful lot of these tree crops are not practical to use directly for human consumption. An awful lot of them could be if we'd spend a few centuries breeding and develop them, as we did with wheat and corn and soybeans and so on. With most of these permacrops, it's much more difficult to do that because, for one thing, they tend to all be very highly heterozygous. It's hard to make them stay genetically stable. But also, you're often talking about something where it takes 5 or 10 years to your first crop, your first fruit crop. So it takes many, many plant generations to get there. That being said, I say, then what are we waiting for? Let's get started. Some of these things have some use as they are. I believe that acorns and chestnuts, for example, have more potential for feeding the human race staple foods. This is not putting them through an animal, eating them directly. than potatoes and rice and corn and so forth. We need to do some things. We need to develop some genetics. We need to develop some technology to utilize them. But if we do so, then we can have both of the benefits of permaculture. We can have the all the non-disruptive, not so invasive on the soil, but also get a very high level of efficiency by eating it directly. So, yeah, that's a great interest of mine, and not a lot of work is being done in that direction that I see, but that's a direction where we should be going.
So, in your book, you kind of challenge the myth of protein. Like, I'm a protein lover. Maybe it's just because I'm a protein addict, but like one of my biggest challenges was being able to like produce enough protein, but you cover, you know, lots of protein in your book. I'm curious about like in the way you set up your homestead, like what's the role of protein in your farming practice?
Well, first of all, I'm a protein lover too. Although as I often mention, Riley in my book with some of my cheeky quips, is I've never seen a protein before. I don't know if there is such a thing as protein. It's hearsay. I've heard people talk about a thing called protein, so I'm gullible. I'll believe, okay, there is such a thing as tryptophan and lysine and all those. So, yeah, if you say so. I know that the foods, I love eating a lot of the foods that are called high protein foods, and grain and legumes are high protein foods, both of them. And it's just ideal to eat most of them. It's best to eat them in combinations, not necessarily at the same time, to get a good balance of the various amino acids. Again, I've never seen an amino acid, but they say. This is just basically using an excuse. A lot of this is just a reactionary traditional conservatism. We've been eating meat for thousands of years. It's so entrenched, and keeping a livestock is so entrenched in our, not only our system, but in our psyche. Our whole mythology is we can't imagine a nutritious diet and a well-maintained soil without animals, when in fact it is exactly the opposite. Maintaining animals and eating animals is actually an obstacle to maintaining the soil and eating well. But it's very difficult to get people to understand that, particularly who are reactionary. I'm not a traditionalist at all. I have not the slightest interest in going back to the good old days. I mean, back in the days when women were barefoot and pregnant and everyone had a few slaves, and you know that I don't see any point in recapitulating our past. I'm always a bit skeptical of these living history museums and stuff that people go to and, oh, the good old days. I don't worship that at all. I see us looking for going forward, but really forward. The things that we've been calling progress for the last century or two are apparently not really progress. They are not sustainable progress. If it's not sustainable, it's not progress. And anyway, all that being said, I'm looking for other ways of dealing with these issues. And veganism and veganic farming are very clearly, from my experience, I'm not going by any philosophy, I have no religious belief on the subject, I have no, nothing that I've read has convinced me of it, it's just my own experience. It's a hell of a lot easier to maintain soil fertility, for example, without using animal manure, using the stuff that the plant food that the earth around me produces, right around me. My garden itself and my adjacent grassland and woodland and so on is producing vast amounts of fertility every year, much easier to collect and utilize than animal dung, which only represents less than 10% of the actual value that the cow or whatever the animal consumed.
So when you're looking to, you know, fertilize your peas or your potatoes or whatever, are you mulching? How are you using leaves? Like, are you mulching leaves directly from the woods, or are you making compost? Like, what is your, you know, practice?
All of the above. All of the above. And I could do any one of those things, but in fact, as much as I can, I do all of them and more, and do more of them. You know, like, for example, I don't tend to worship nitrogen, people, any more than I worship protein. I like to be sure I have a lot of bulk in my diet, which obviously means fiber. If I have a lot of plant foods, I'm getting a lot of fiber. I'm eating a large amount of it to get that protein, and I'm happy with that. I'm a ravenous eater. I eat lots. Likewise with the soil, I'm not analyzing it much to look at how much nitrogen I'm getting. If I worship anything, it's humus. My experience is if the level of humus in the soil is naturally high, then for one thing, most soil pest disease problems will be very minimalized. But in terms of soil nutrition, nutrient lacks, including nitrogen, they will be there. And so back to what you're saying about my using leaves and rain meal chips and grass and stuff for fertility. I dwell on this a whole lot in my book because it's very, very important. Conventional, regarding leaves, for example, conventional wisdom is that leaves do not have much nitrogen in them. They have so much carbon and so much nitrogen. That's only true if you're comparing it with animal manure, and it's true of animal manure only if you're comparing it to 10-10-10. In fact, there is a considerable amount of nitrogen along with all the minerals and trace things in leaves. It is indeed very small, relatively small in proportion to the carbon. And so it means in order to get enough nitrogen or potassium or calcium or phosphorus or any of those things in the soil, you have to use a much larger volume of, say, tree leaves than, let's say, cow or chicken manure or something. But the other side of it is it's much easier to get, to collect, grow, if you will, a vast amount of those things. We usually think of them as waste byproducts anyway. When I was a kid, people break their leaves, pile them in a ditch, and burn them. That's how much we valued them for fertility.
Right.
But if we take these things and apply them to soil in huge amounts, then someone might say, aren't we in danger of having too much humus? And I say, too much humus, isn't that kind of like too much sex or something? What are you talking about? You know, is this a thing, too much humus? If you have to have very high humus levels in order to get enough, let's say, nitrogen. When you use a lot of leaves, and even more so, when I use a lot of rameal wood, in other words, chipped brush, which is even more high carbon and low nitrogen, I'm putting huge amounts in there and adding virtually no nitrogen. But what I've discovered is in the process of all the things that decay that, starting off with the white molds and then all the bacteria, all the centipedes and roly-polies and earthworms and all the things that get in there and eat those chips, that rotting wood and the stuff that eats the rotting wood and so on. Somehow in the process of all that, nitrogen appears. Like I often look to quote the line from the movie, you know, build it and they will come. Keep high nitrogen there. You don't necessarily have to add nitrogen. Incidentally, that's something I always refer rather sarcastically to as cake mix gardening, cake mix farming. And organic gardening is very much based on cake mix principles, just as much as conventional farming is. We bring in something from some, we get so many tons per acre of rock phosphate, so many tons per lime, so many tons of sulfamic, all these different things. Bring them in, put them in the soil, stir, grow a crop, and then send the crop out to market. That is, to me, cake mix farming. Really sustainable, truly organic farming will involve the soil producing pretty much, if not all, of its own nutrients, which it does. It becomes complicated when we're market gardening. We're sending a lot of that stuff off to market, the marketplace, and it never comes back. It did in the old days when people would collect night soil from domestic latrines and compost it and take it back out into the country. That doesn't happen anymore. So we have broken the cycle there. But even then, even giving that loss, there are still ways that we can keep producing this stuff from the land. The land that begets our food can also beget its own food.
It's cool. You know, and just to add on to that, it's like as I was clearing, because our space was totally overgrown, and as I was clearing space, I at a certain point I was like, okay, we can't cut down any more trees, and because I want the leaves to fall. And another cool resource in Maine, I don't know how you feel about it, but seaweed. It takes like 5 minutes to fill a couple trash bags with seaweed.
In some respects, seaweed is the ultimate sustainable fertility because, as I was just saying before, the stuff we send to market or that we flush down our toilet, typically, and also the stuff that comes from erosion and so on, all that ends up in the sea. And so the sea vegetables, and with seaweed as food, certainly, and also seaweed, like I say, for fertility and so on, particularly in terms of trace minerals, it's not a good source of humus because basically the seaweed does not need, because it's an aquatic plant, marine plant, it doesn't need cellulose for its structural, like a tree does. It basically has algaes or something that keep it. So it's not a great source of humus, but that's okay. We have zillions and zillions of land plant sources of humus, but it does have an awful lot of things, particularly some of those very rarest, hard to get, iodine being a classical one, but all kinds of, you know, selenium and sulfur and boron, a lot of these things that end up going into the ocean. That's the best way to retrieve them and bring them back. For you, where you are, and to a lesser extent for me when I where I am, that's not that difficult to do. In fact, there's a great risk of overdoing it. Apparently now people are very concerned about too many people cutting off the rocks, the rock weed off, and taking it away faster than it can grow. So I'm sensitive to the fact that can be a real concern. But insofar as we can do it sustainably, it's great. I am concerned about the carbon footprint of harvesting and bringing that stuff far from this coast. If you live near the coast, it's much, much easier to do. For me, it means driving, burning a lot of gas to come down there and get it and bring it back. For someone in Iowa to try to fertilize their land in any way with significant amounts of seaweed is very problematic, as it is to use mined products, lime and phosphate. As I mentioned in the book, I started off my working career in the mining business, and I decided that it sucked. I wanted out of there. It was not. I wanted something more sustainable and more that involved recycling. And I realized that organic farming, gardening was the ideal recycling thing. But then as I got into it, I started hearing people talk about so many tons per acre of sulpo mag and of phosphate and so on. And I said to myself, I thought I got out of that business. Is really organic, if a farming system is totally dependent on mining and the grinding and moving of stuff around, the huge carbon footprint of moving these things hundreds of thousands of miles, how organic is that? And how sustainable is it? And so that's when I become very cynical about some aspects of organic farming, while at the same time realizing that truly organic gardening is it's a panacea insofar as it is such a thing. It's the way we should be going.
So, you know, other things in your book that are like, I don't know, just the way it's written, it's funny, it's engaging, and it just makes, you know, growing so many of the foods that we take for granted, it just makes it seem fun, you know?
And I don't try to be, by the way, I don't try to be funny. I always try to be dead serious, but it's something about me. It's just, that shit just comes out. I don't know what it is. I can't seem to, I seem like I have an incorrigible need to make myself laugh. And then if someone else, if it tickles their funny bone too, well, okay. But I don't try to be funny.
Well, you know, you know, whatever. When you're funny, you don't have to try.
I guess that's it.
But so can you talk about, so like one of the things that I really liked in this book, again, because I've been like really, I went from a gardener, then I got into permaculture, and so it's just cool to hear, you know, how you've like taken from all these things to create your own like pretty experimental stuff going on, but a lot of, you know, mean potato stuff without the meat. Can you talk about, like, so polyculture is a combination of plants that work well together. Can you talk about some of your favorite, or a companion planting? Can you talk about some of your favorite examples of your best companion plants?
Happy to. Incidentally, I don't do anywhere near as much as I wish I did with when we're talking about permacrops. I do dabble around a lot with, I have chestnuts, I have carrageenan pea shrub, and do some of the acorns. I do all of those things a little bit, but I basically dabble with them. And I don't have anything that could be remotely be called a forest farm, forest garden. And the vast majority of stuff on my plate does not come from perennial, or at least from tree crops. I would like to expand that very much. I would like to very much increase the very small role which currently acorns and chestnuts have in my diet. I would like to have them be big items in the middle of the plate, the big entree. I'm not there yet. So yes, I'm basically doing what most people are doing, disturbing the soil, planting annual, you know, row crops, although I'm doing them in a very radical way, but still doing those. And that's most of the things on my diet are things like, on my plate are things like corn and leeks and Brussels sprouts and potatoes and wheat and so on. And so therefore I ask myself, if I'm not eating directly from the forest, which is really ideal, to what extent can I eat indirectly from the forest? And that's when we get down to the using leaves, shredded leaves particularly, and rain meal chips and so on. Insofar as I'm building the soil, what it amounts to is I am parlaying something of which I have, most people would say too much, you know, brush, woody stuff, leaves and so on, parlaying them into something that's like Brussels sprouts and corn and so on. In other words, I'm spinning a straw into gold. And to me, that is, it's kind of a compromise over eating directly from the forest. But on the other hand, for many, many centuries, we've developed a whole panoply of wonderful foods which are not forest crops. And I have no intention of stopping eating those, however much I might like to augment the role of tree crops in my diet. And so my real way of dealing with it, again, is to use the tree crops. To me, leaves and rain meal chips are the ultimate tree crop. And obviously I don't eat them directly, but parlaying them into the things that I do eat. Now, I don't know if I've lost track from the original question. Oh, you were talking about
I was asking what your favorite companion plants are. What are your favorite polycultures that you work with?
Yeah. And most of my quote polycultures usually are binary. They usually involve two things. Sometimes there's three or more things in them. And some of them are the traditional ones that everyone talks about, that this goes good with this. Quite a lot of them I've invented myself and found out some that work well and better than others. One of the main things that I do with my system is everything is intensive beds, not in raised beds. I hate raised beds, but intensive beds and wide space. They're actually 6 feet between centers, of which 4.5 feet is the bed and 1.5 feet is the path in between them. And I generally avoid walking on the beds and stay on the path. And so it's a little like a French intensive method, except they're not raised beds, and I don't double dig them every year and so on. And so within those, all my things are rotated around. So any given bed, this year, if it happens to be in, sunflowers and pole beans, next year it might be in potatoes, and then it might be followed by peas and carrots and so on. So I not only have them all mixed, so this helps a lot with pest problems and so on. I don't have some big block of any one thing. Even my grains and things tend to be intermixed. There'll be buckwheat alternating with soybeans, and then maybe alternating with field corn, alternating with cabbage and so on. So it makes it very confusing for a predator, a pest, to find their way around. And I have all kinds of pests, and they do some damage, but they tend to be a little bit restrained just by the hodgepodgey nature of my, and also the rotation. Because it was there last year, you can be sure it won't be there next year. And that helps particularly with soil-borne diseases and pests and stuff. So to get specifically into your thing, well, just for example, one of my favorites is peas and carrots, or more generally, any kind of legume, but particularly peas, whether it's table peas or snow peas or snap peas. And I'll have a row down the middle of each bed, a trellis of, let's say, table peas. Then on either side of that, I'll have at least two rows of carrots. And they like each other. They do well together. And the conventional wisdom is that this works because, well, carrots are a taproot. They bring up potassium and calcium and so on from deep down, which the peas need. And the peas, on the other hand, are a legume. They fix nitrogen from the air into the soil, which the carrots need. Well, actually, that's a bunch of hooey. That's not the way it works at all. Because, in fact, the carrots, they pump up those minerals, but they pump it up for themselves. They're not making it available to the peas. In fact, the only way that'll end up going to the peas is if you eat that carrot, compost the poop, and put that poop where you have peas next year or whatever crop. This year, the peas are not benefiting from those minerals. The same thing, the peas that are fixing that nitrogen, they're mainly fixing it for themselves. There may be some leaching into the soil, but basically they're not making nitrogen for the carrots. They're making it for themselves. The way it works is that the carrots are producing enough, they're pumping up enough potassium and calcium for themselves. You need to have enough in the soil for the peas. But if you put enough in there for the peas, they do not have to share it with the carrots. On the other hand, there better be enough natural nitrogen in the soil already for the carrots, because they're not going to get it from the peas. But if there is enough, then they don't have to share, the peas don't have to share, neither of them has to share either of those nutrients with the other. They've got their own. And so it's not so much that they help each other. It's just that they don't get in each other's face. They're convivial because they're just filling little different niches in terms of fertility, and also in terms of shade and the root structure. Like pea roots are very, because they're a legume, they're very shallow roots. They reach out, but they never go more than a few inches below the surface. Whereas carrots, being a taproot, they go down beyond what the actual carrot is. They'll reach down a foot or more and bring up things. So they're not taking other space. Putting peas and parsnips together, they would not be so happy because they're both duking it out for the exact same things. Oh. So those are some examples. Another one of my favorites is cabbage. We'll alternate cabbage or Brussels sprouts. For one thing, I usually like to plant them in leftover mulch from last year, so I don't even have to disturb the soil for at least that 1 year. I get a second year of use out of my mulch. And I will usually interplant them with several different things. One is endive or lettuce. That works well in between the plants. Some years I've done edamame in between them. There's quite a few crops that intercrop well with cabbage. But I'm not just satisfied to get two or three food crops off of them. I also like to plant white Dutch clover. among the cabbage, and it makes a living mulch. In addition to whatever leaf mulch they have there, it'll make a living mulch on top of that, without competing in any way with the cabbage or whatever other crop I plant there. So I'm actually getting two or more crops for food, but I'm also getting food for next year. I really love the idea of the soil producing a compost material or a living mulch or green manure for next year while I'm getting a food crop. That's really ideal. Instead of having taken a year off to grow a green manure crop, which I also do plenty, in some cases I can actually get a green manure crop at the same time I'm getting something to eat.
That is awesome. You know, one of the crops that that Aaron Parker was suggesting for my property was skirret. I don't know if you've ever grown that. It's a biennial root vegetable. And as you were talking, I was like, there's these perennial beans called thicket beans. Have you heard of this?
I don't. What's that name again?
Thicket bean. It's a perennial bean. And I was just thinking, what a cool polyculture that would be to have skirrets and thicket beans.
Should go very well. That'd be a good. There's an umbilifer going with a legume. That should work very well as far as that goes. Now, there's some things about, I don't know anything about the bean you're talking about, but I've done a skirret before. The issue with all of these permacrop things is how much do we and can we and are we likely to eat of them? Skirret, I tried a little. I like it very much. A very sweet, kind of a parsnipy kind of a thing. I would eat a fair amount of it. Am I going to eat huge amounts of it? Not too likely. I mean, even though I'm very flexible, I like to adjust. I do make major adjustments on my diet to allow for what's quick and easy to grow. For example, I tend to eat a lot of buckwheat as opposed to other grains because it is so eco-efficient. It produces so much with so little from the soil. Still, I still eat a lot of corn and a lot of wheat and a lot of barley. And likewise, I'm still going to grow lots of carrots and parsnips and things like that, even if I'm also growing skirret. So I guess what I'm saying is there's a limit to how much these things are actually. A lot of them become cool, trendy things that we permaculturalists, you know, there's all these cool things that we're growing in our, quote, forest garden. Do they actually get eaten? I remember many years ago going to visit a fellow who will remain nameless, a nice guy, good friend of mine, who was very much like an apostle for permacrops and all these very, very cool things he was selling through his nursery and stuff. And while visiting with him, I happened to look in his refrigerator. It was mainly included Miracle Whip salad dressing and you know, pretty much everything there was from the store, if not from the co-op, if that. And relatively little was on his plate. If anything, there were some fruits, there was some jam and applesauce and things. Relatively little came from these crops that he was doing so much. That makes me a little skeptical. I want us to focus on the things that we're really going to use lots of. It was certainly limited how much of those we're going to sell. There's not much of a market for most of those things. But even ourselves, how much can you eat? One of the things I like mixing with my a lot of my crops, I have things I like to stick in between them as catch crops. For example, with my cucumbers, I like to have, before they're planted and while they're growing, on either side of them, a crop, a very, very quick to grow crop. And I have a handful of those that I like. And some of them lend themselves, scallions, for example. I can grow lots and lots of scallions in very little space. Hey, I can always use more scallions. Another one is radishes. Well, I don't eat many radishes. In fact, I have been the curator of a collection of
radishes.
I won't say I hate them, because I'm not that much of a bigot, but I'm not very excited about them. I really could care. A little bit in a potato salad is okay. Yeah, I almost hate them. So they're a very cool food. I wish I loved them. And also, I wish they were a staple thing, not just a little salad vegetable. I wish they were something that would have protein. Because, again, they lend themselves to a very, very short season. Lettuce is that way. Lettuce, you can always stick some lettuce in between something that takes a longer season. And, again, there's a limit to how much, at least if I have too much lettuce, at least I can usually sell it. But there's a limit to how much lettuce I can eat, certainly radishes. I wish there were a lot more of those crops. Scallions is one of my favorites because, like I say, I can pretty much always use more scallions and help to stretch my bulb onions further. But, that's the question that always comes up is how much are you going to actually use this thing? It sounds good on paper, you know, growing these crops, but are we being real?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I loved your book, because it really made me think, like, yeah, wait, all this other stuff is great, like, but I'm not going to have hazelnuts for 5 years. I'm not going to, you know, I'm not going to have any of this stuff for a while. Like, we planted a lot of chestnut trees and things like that. But
when you say five years, and that's true. I've had them start in 3 years, but yeah, 5 years. But that's one of the things that makes me more excited about hazelnuts than about any of the other nut crops. They're not only very hardy, very practical here, but they will produce, and for a tree crop, 5 years is nothing. And I get a lot per amount of space. And my main concern with hazelnuts is blue jays and squirrels and cracking technology, because where I am, I can't grow most of these hazel burts and things like that that easily. I grow the American hazelnut, which is very, very hardy, a little small, I have a cracking machine that cracks them. But the main problem with them, aside from those pests I mentioned, is the technology involved. And that's true of a lot of these tree crops. That is not a reason, in my book, to poo-poo those crops. It just means we have to do before they're really going to catch on. I mean, I could eat any amount of hazelnuts. Hazelnut butter is like, if you've ever had a whole wheat toast with hazelnut butter on it, I mean, after that, sex will seem boring. I mean, this is just incredible tasty thing, hazelnut butter. I could eat gallons of it, far more than peanut butter or anything, but I cannot produce and process as much as I would like of that. So that's the obstacle to that.
Hey, let me ask you one more question. You were talking about growing cabbage and stuff. I'm wondering, what's your companion plant with broccoli?
That one I move around with every year. I've experimented with some different combinations. Lately, one thing I've been doing with broccoli is having down the middle row of that bed. I never think of the crop. I always think of the bed. The middle of a trellis with indeterminate cherry tomatoes on it. The variety which I bred myself and really love more than anything else is called a gardener's sweetheart. And it's a lovely little cherry tomato, and it grows up a trellis, and it'll get space the rest of the bed on either side of it. And one thing I've been doing lately is putting broccoli on both sides of it, and usually in between the broccoli plants, either scallions or lettuce plants. Something comes out early, and that works very well. Before that, I've tried several different things. My broccoli tool drawer is still a little flexible. I'm shifting, moving things around with different things. There's a lot of things that can go with broccoli, but that's one that I like. I don't go anywhere near as much as I love broccoli. I don't go anywhere near as much of that as I do cabbage. I use more cabbage year-round, mainly in the form of sauerkraut, and so I'll use much larger quantities of that.
And cabbage, you intercrop it with lettuce and dice.
And those several things I mentioned. And incidentally, one could do most of those pretty well in broccoli, too. Broccoli, of course, can be much closer together. It can be like a foot and a half apart, whereas I give at least 2 feet to cabbage. And so that's why it works fine, at least between broccoli plants within the row, to do, like I say, lettuce and some of those things. I basically put two rows of cabbage in a bed with or without the tomatoes or a legume. I also do the cabbage. Usually in my beds I have a row of some kind of pole beans, usually white runner beans, down the middle on the naked poles, and then have cabbage on either side. That's what I've been doing for several years, and or Brussels sprouts. And that works very well. But broccoli, you could easily put three rows of broccoli in a bed and then have something in between them, because they're a more compact plant. Kohlrabi even more so. You know, these are all Brassica loracea, but they're very different in how much space they demand.
Wow. Yeah. And this, again, this is like, as a vegan, this is why I like hearing this, you know, seems like when in doubt, just put a trellis with pole beans down the middle, you know?
That's kind of true. Yeah, that's good, true. And there's any number of things. There's very few things that don't go well with pole beans down the middle. In recent years, several years now, I've gotten some of my favorite. I grow several different pole beans, but one of my favorites for growing on naked poles is white runner beans. The particular variety I have is called Grammy Tilly. But white runner beans, which are like scarlet runner beans, except they're white-seeded and white-flowered. And they, I call them the Northern Gardener's Lima Bean. They look and act just like a lima bean. They cook and taste just like a lima bean, except they're much fatter than a lima bean. And the problem with that is, you know, I mean, they're just wonderful. And then on either side of them, I will plant very often the cabbage family things. There's any number of things that could go on either side, but broccoli is an excellent one.
That's awesome. Yeah, and you know, when we spoke on the phone the other day, I was telling you, I wasn't even going to grow potatoes. And then a friend gave me some potatoes and then that they grew. And I was like, oh my, because in Colorado, I just couldn't grow potatoes. And I saw you were growing potatoes with bush beans. And I thought that was a brilliant polyculture as well. So,
well, I do and I don't. I do both. What you'll hear people say, several people told me that when they plant them together, this is one of these cases where a companion, where they actually do help each other, that potatoes help to repel the Mexican bean beetle, and beans in turn help to repel to deter the Colorado potato beetle. And my experience is those are both true to some extent, but not at all completely. I can't simply say, okay, I'm going to worry about picking potato bugs because I've got beans here. It's not a panacea. But I do lots of things that are not panaceas. If it helps at all, I do it. That works very well. And what I do more often than not is not, that's one of the few crops that I often don't companion plant. I'll often plant potatoes by themselves and plant them under a very heavy mulch, a combination of hay and leaves. Hay itself is not usually adequate because almost always too many of my potatoes are too shallow that when they form under it, they'll get a lot of green on them. So I'll almost always put a layer of shredded leaves on top of that. But potatoes, I do both ways. Sometimes I'll companion them with beans and sometimes not.
So you'll just throw leaves over your potatoes?
Well, first of all, as soon as they're up, a very heavy layer of hay. There's heavy, lots and lots of old crappy spoil hay on it. And then on top, then after that settles down a while, then yes, I will go through and put a light mulch, usually, well, heavy if I've got it, mulch of shredded leaves on top of that, mainly because hay or straw, you know, however heavy you put it on, like it's like there's all those interstices, and by virtue of putting the mulch on, causes the potatoes to form right at the soil level, which in some ways is great. The potatoes you get will be almost dirt-free, easily collected, you know, don't need washing much and stuff. That's wonderful. But on the other hand, because they're forming shallowly, even with a pretty heavy mulch, I find some of my, it depends on the variety too, some of them will tend to get sun scald or get green, making them inedible from the sun shining on. And so to avert that, I use the grass for the mulch, the bulk of my mulch, but on top of it, I'll put a layer of shredded leaves, because even a half inch of shredded leaves will have the equivalent of 6 inches of hay as far as keeping sun out, keeping weeds down, holding in moisture, and so on. So for that particular crop, I like to use lots of both of them.
Yeah, I mean, I've never grown potatoes, so I thought you had to just keep shoveling dirt on it. So it's cool to hear. I don't have to keep like...
That is a good way of doing it. That's a problematic thing to me. I usually grow potatoes both ways. Some I will hill up with dirt the conventional way, and it works quite well. I'll usually have less trouble with voles, with rodents getting under the hay. That's the biggest problem with the grass, is getting rodents under. You get a beautiful crop, what you get, but you find a lot of them that are hollowed out or something. And so I also do them under... just hilling them up the soil. One of the big disadvantages to hilling them up the soil is I need to have like maybe as much as 3 feet between rows in order to get enough soil to hill them up. The potatoes don't require that. The potatoes could be a foot in every direction and be just hunky-dory. And so that's one of the nice things. When I put them under hay, I'll put them only 2 feet between rows, and even that's more than they need.
Well, just as, you know, since we're geeking out on plant stuff, I'm wondering, have you experimented with growing lentils or hemp or garbanzo? Or do you know anybody in Maine growing those crops?
I haven't grown hemp. I'm eager to do that, particularly now that the law is a little more tolerant of it. I would love to grow hemp. I'm not even used to using hemp products. I'm not used to using hemp oil and hemp seed as foods. And I would love to, from what little I've tasted, they're very tasty, and I would love to grow them. And for years, I've wanted to grow hemp for fiber. And, of course, it was illegal to grow any kind at all, even though there's no THC in it to amount to anything. But for that reason, I haven't done it. I would like to do that. As far as chickpeas, yes, I grow chickpeas almost every year. They're very practical to grow in Maine. Particularly, there's two races or types of chickpeas. The ones you always buy in the store, the big kind of cream-colored, you know, the whitish, roundish ones, those are not so easy to grow here as the so-called desi types. There's a lot of varieties, which are, a lot of them are from East Africa or India and South Asia. They are smaller and they are more angular shape, and they tend to be, a lot of them are brick colors. Some of them are black and green, all kinds of colors, but a lot of them are red. And I found my experience in Maine is that kind does better than any of the others for me. And I have pretty good luck with those. I often companion them with chufa, which we can come back to. But you mentioned lentils. I've grown lentils in my scatter seed project. Generally, I find them not very practical. You can grow them here. I've tried dozens of varieties, and they're disappointing. They don't yield well. One can do it. I've even heard that in parts of the world where lentils are grown as a winter crop, like in Egypt and India, stuff like that, even there they are not as high yielding. But they're kind of a catch crop, and they'll get a lot of food for people out of it, but not as well as a lot of other legumes, for example, might grow.
Yeah, they look difficult to grow. I feel like you talked about the desi chickpeas in your book. I know you did, actually.
Back just for a moment to what we were saying before about I like companioning with chufa. I've been experimenting with that. Most people don't know chufa, and I find it a very exciting crop. I've only been doing it a few years now. It's also called garden almond or ground almond. And in the South, it can become an invasive weed. I mean, I've heard around Lake Pontchartrain in Louisiana, there's thousands of acres that are this stuff, why it chokes out everything else. Here, it can be a perennial, but in Maine, it is not. And in the South, a lot of farmers plant it to attract ducks, and then in the wetlands, and then they'll lease out, give hunting rights to people to come and shoot those ducks. They don't think of it as a human food. It's a very good human food. It's traditionally grown. It's been grown for many, many, many centuries in Egypt. It's grown a lot in Chufa in Spain, and Chufa is used to make a beverage called horchata, which is a very, very tasty thing. People in this country who have had horchata, typically in Mexico, it's made from rice. But real horchata is made from Chufa. It's a very sweet almond. It's kind of like almond milk. It's very tasty. Anyway, I find it easy to grow, and I like it very much. I grow some of it. That's one of the things I like growing that, okay, we can say it's a perennial crop. Technically, it is. It's the same thing with pterosols, which is what we call, people call them sunchokes. Yeah, they're a perennial crop. They have a lot of the benefits of a permacrop, but you do disturb the soil in digging them. And I don't cry a lot about that, but I'm just saying if we're looking for crops that you can leave the soil intact, well, then those don't fit the bill very well.
How do they taste? I've never heard of these earth chestnuts before. I'm looking at it online right now. This looks amazing.
Do you have a chufa now?
Yeah.
Or ground almond? They have a taste. It's a sweet, very sweet taste, and very much like almonds with a little sweetening on them. The only thing about them, there's an after, not a taste, but an after effect of fibrous. Sometimes they chew and you feel like a little bit of sawdust in your mouth. And that, I think, is the main thing to keep people from eating them more. You can buy them online. You can order them. There's a snack food. They're toasted. Or they call them tiger nuts. And they, they're toasted. They're very, very tasty, crunchy, but they are a little bit fibrous. The main way that I use them is I grind them. I get them very, very dry. I grind them in my Corona mill a few times. Get them very, I'll crack them and then dry them for a day or two and then grind them fine. I'll get them to be a very, very fine flour. And then I use it as a cereal mix. I'll mix it along with a pterosol meal or a sunchoke meal, which I make by take the artichoke tubers and chip them up and dry them and then grind them into a very, very fine flour. And both chufa meal and a pterosol meal, I will mix with cornmeal. I make a breakfast cereal, which is to die for. It's mainly corn, but it also has chufa meal, also acorn meal in it, pterosol meal, and I'm forgetting one or two things. It has several ingredients in it, and it's very, very, very tasty, real, real rich tasting thing. And when I cook it, toward the end of it being done, I add a big dollop of peanut butter to it, and that kind of cooks up too.
That's, and this is like why I'm just so drawn to your work, because you can just tell that it's all experimentation and just, having fun and like making shit up,
And one of the biggest, coolest things about that is, first of all, anyone who grows a garden knows this is true of that. You got all kinds of so cool stuff you couldn't afford to, asparagus. My uncle used to be big on it, crazy about asparagus. He was a big glutton for it, and he always put tons of butter on it, and he wanted so much, he never could get as much as he wanted. And I eat asparagus till up the wazoo, till I'm sick of asparagus. You used to in the past, especially, it was like early in the spring, with so much, people can't afford it. I can't afford to eat anything but asparagus for a couple of weeks. And so there's so many of these foods that, as any gardener knows, we have the best of the best. I mean, corn on the cob from the grocery store, your own fresh pick, no comparison. But in addition to that, and this is one of the big benefits I've got from my scatter seed project, is growing a whole plethora of crop plants which are not in the grocery store at all. Some of them are not even in the usual seed of chufa. You're not going to find it in Johnny's or Fedco catalog. You're certainly not going to find it in any store anywhere. And this is a fantastic food in my diet, along with acorn meal, along with some foods that I've invented, like I say, a pterosol meal, Jerusalem artichoke meal. I make my own garlic powder. Take my own garlic, dry it, grind it up, and get the garlic powder, which is much richer than the stuff I could buy. I've done the same thing with a kind of paprika. Take ripe peppers and dry them and grind them up in my Corona mill and get something. It is technically it's paprika, but it's nicer than paprika. It's sweeter or less, I don't know. All kinds of things you can make by growing your own and making your own, prepping your own, processing things. I feel kind of sorry for Bill Gates. He can't afford to eat a lot of the stuff that I eat. I have it on my plate every day. He can't afford it.
Yeah, well,
he can't find it. He can't find it in a store. He doesn't know about it.
Well, I hope he's not listening to this podcast. Well,
I know. I hate to make him feel discouraged or something, but eat your heart out, Bill Gates. You're not eating like Will Bunsell, sorry.
No, I mean, and that's, you know, it's, you know, a lot of people, you know, there's a lot of talk about decolonizing your diet and all this. And I feel like, you know, what you're doing is a real interesting take on, you know, a kind of lower tech form of eating, like you were just talking about making your own flour. And in your book, you also talk about making oil, which that never even occurred to me. Like my wife is going to kill me if I start making oil. So I'm just wondering, like, how?
Well, she can relax. You're not going to make a heck of a lot of oil, probably, because it is not all that efficient to do. I now have a little oil press made in Holland. It cost $140. It came in a bubble wrap pack. It's a rugged little thing. You clamp it onto a bench, and now I can make my own oil, which is very, very cool. But it's slow and tedious enough to make it that I'm still buying most of it. Insofar as I use vegetable oil, I'm buying most of it. But here's a really cool. This really emphasizes what I was saying before about doing your own, growing your own. Yes, you can make your own sunflower oil now with this thing. You can buy sunflower oil, too. That's really good. You can make your own da-da-da oil. You can buy some. But here's some things you cannot. I discovered by accident when I grow cucumbers and save a lot of them for seed, invariably, a lot of them go by. They end up being overripe. They aren't good for eating fresh, and they're 10 times more than I need for seed. I've got enough seed for the next 10 or 20 years. What do I do with a pound or two of leftover cucumber seed? And I tried putting it through the oil thing and getting cucumber seed oil. And, oh, my God. The other thing is muskmelons. If I either grow muskmelons or even if I buy one from the store that may be a hybrid or something, I don't know about the seed, I don't care about it, doesn't matter, I always save the seed. I value the seed almost as much as the melon. Save the seed to dry it and put it through my oil press. And I haven't had real butter for like 40, about 50, a little over 50 years now. But I don't remember it tasting quite as good as muskmelon seed oil. It is to die for. Exquisite taste. None of you guys have had it. So sorry.
Well, I'm going to get your address, Will, so better slow down. Well, just really quickly, can you just, because people listening to this have probably never even thought about making their own flour. Can you walk me through it? Like, you got some buckwheat, like,
yeah, buckwheat is different from all the true grains for that in positive and negative ways. If one is wanting to grow one's own buckwheat, this is one of the most practical ones, and it's very undemanding of soil, very easy to grow in your own garden. The one thing about, unlike the true grains, buckwheat is not at all cold tolerant, so you don't want to plant it until after danger of frost. But in fact, it's ideal not to plant it till around the 4th of July. The Acadian potato farmers up in the St. Lawrence Valley, they grow lots of buckwheat as a rotation crop with potatoes. And they don't plant it until around the 4th of July, mainly because that way it grows very, very, it's a short season crop. And they would like it to be ripening about the time of the first killing frost, because it ripens irregularly. You'll have some that are still flowering and some that are all shattering seed. And if you count on the natural frost to naturally kill it down, then that solves the problem of when to harvest it. So, yes, you plant it around the 4th of early July. And the very important thing is, if you're planting this for your own use to process, not only to grow in your backyard, but to thresh in your driveway, let's say, and to process in your kitchen, you do not want to grow the tartary-type buckwheat, which a lot of buckwheats, and the kind that's grown up in the St. John's River Valley. You have to, it's the only way you can practically remove the hull from it is with a roller mill, which you and I can't regularly do. There are roller mills up and down the St. John's Valley that process this stuff. And the problem with roller milling is the process that was invented for making white flour. It removes the germ and the bran from the wheat in that case, and does the same thing with buckwheat. And so I don't want to lose that. So moreover, you can't do it in your own backyard. If you grow instead the Japanese buckwheat, the shiny, glossy, dark brown, almost black kind, plant that kind. And what I do is, when the ripe seed is all cleaned and winnowed, I put it through my Corona mill, hand mill, at a very slightly loose setting. And what it does, the kernel almost completely gets ground up in a fairly fine flour, chalky flour, enough so it'll go through the sifter. And virtually all of the hulls will end up being broken but whole enough that they will not go through the hull, through the sifter. And the tiny, tiny amount of little flakes that do go through will not be objectionable at all, because Japanese buckwheat, the hull does not have that horribly bitter taste, which Tartary buckwheat, if you didn't roller mill it and tried to do it the other way, getting little bits of hull in it, you could not eat it. It is gut-wrenching, gaggy, bitter.
Yeah, and so then you dry it, you put it through the thing, sift it, and then you have flour. And, like, I don't think people realize how, you know, like, or I guess I didn't really realize, like, flour is just some dried shit and ground up.
Yep, it's just dried seeds is all it is. And keep in mind, and the nice thing about buckwheat, too, is unlike the grains, it has a good balance of all the amino acids. So you don't necessarily have to mix it with a legume or something. Yeah, the downside of this is I really adore kasha. I love kasha for breakfast. I love having it with rice. I love it with stir fry and stuff like that. I mean, most of my ancestors came from northern England, but my soul was born in Budapest. And I love kasha. And I don't know of any way that you or I or your listeners can make kasha in their backyard or whatever. We can easily make buckwheat. So there's two things we can do. We can make soba buckwheat noodles. So I've messed around with it. It's not undoable, but it's easy to make buckwheat pancakes. Anything to do with buckwheat flour. One of my favorite things to do is make kind of like pluies, sort of like unleavened, either with just buckwheat or buckwheat with wheat. Make a very thin pancake, very thin, kind of like a chapati. And then I make this really luscious tasting onions and peppers and garlic and sauerkraut and some raw hard apple like Ben Davis that doesn't get mushy, and a little bit of caraway seed and other things I'm totally forgetting about, and make this stir fry mixture, kind of sauerkraut with tart, tangy savory mixture, and roll that up in one of these things and eat it kind of like a, well, we sometimes refer to them as gypsy tacos, we call them. Really, really elegant tasting things. You've never had a real meal until you had this stuff.
That's amazing. That sounds great. Yeah, it was just, there was all kinds of stuff in your book like that that just like got me pumped. Like when you were talking about making wheat, and then there's like this weird little meatloaf thing that's not quite seitan.
Yeah. No, it's
sounds
all wheat.
Great.
It's not seitan at all. It's everything is there. It's not just a concentrated gluten, but it acts more enough like it that it gives you the shape that you want in an entree, like a loaf, like a piece of meat.
Well, I feel like, you know, we've covered a lot of the vegetable questions that I had or topics of conversation. Did you, like, we were talking earlier and you were saying that the scatter seed project is sort of, I don't know, on hiatus or something, but that was a really cool initiative on your part. You were saying like it wasn't like, you didn't make any money off it or anything, but it was just like a fun project. Can you talk about the scatter seed project and like why you did that?
Yeah, and when we say, as I explained before, it's on hiatus, mainly because I've had several years of reduced or, you know, almost no funding lately, and I'm losing stuff like crazy. That things I've been preserving for 30, 40 years and making them available to people. I don't consider it done. I'm going on 70 years old, and I'm still trying to decide what I want to be when I grow up. But I definitely want to get scatter seed. As I develop a more sustainable source of revenue funding, I want to not only get back, rebuild the collections, get back everything, rescue the stuff that I've lost, which in most cases is not that difficult to do, get it back and running again, and moreover, find some younger person or persons to take over when I do finally buy the farm, that they can keep this thing going, because it's a very useful thing. As I explained before, I don't make any money on scatter seed. I totally depend on donations and grants and stuff to do it. It's a losing thing, just like a library. You know, you don't expect to make money on having all these books, but society in general wants to have those books there, so we come up with the money for it. Some big benefits I've gotten out of the scatter seed, though, is half of these things that we're talking about, if it weren't for my scatter seed project, I probably never would have heard of chufa. I never would have heard of some particular variety of something or other that's on my table every day. I eat it all the time. And so it's been enriched by just the process of having the scatter seed project and looking at crops and varieties from all over the world. Another thing it's also done, it's part of the reason you're having me on your program here, is it's made me much better known than I otherwise would be. And in fact, it's one of the things that led to my being invited to write that book, which is being fairly profitable for me. I get invited to speak at a lot of groups, a lot of conferences and stuff, and that is profitable. So even though I don't make anything on scatter seed at all, far from it, it has led to some opportunities that have been profitable, I have to say.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And, you know, I mean, for me, it's also inspiring, just personally speaking. You know, this is my podcast. I can say something about myself or whatever. But, you know, I'm a musician by trade for 20 years. And I just can't imagine myself wanting to be a full-time musician, you know, when I'm 60. And the idea of, like, changing careers and or phasing into something else, it's like, it's inspiring to see, you know, how you've just reinvented yourself.
Yeah, and I've done it several times of necessity, because I started out, at one point I was a professional musician and a cabaret singer and taught music, taught guitar in particular and stuff. And other times I started off in the mining business. I was originally planning to be a mining engineer, if you can imagine anything quite so ludicrous as that. I'm also a little bit of an artist. I used to do oil paintings and sell them and so on. And those are mostly things I don't do much anymore, except a little bit for my own pleasure. And mainly because, well, to use the example of art, someone that I knew way back in my youth said once, it's too bad you don't do art anymore. And I said, no, that's not true at all. It's just that I now have 85 acres of canvas that I work on. And my crops are my, I pay very much attention to the aesthetics when I'm planting a bed. It's kind of like feng shui kind of a thing. I don't just think about what's my production. I certainly care a lot about, you know, which works best and what give me the most yield and all that. But I also think, geez, how's this going to look? Because, you know, it's going to take me, you know, 20 minutes to eat that thing, but I'm going to be looking at it and walking past it all year long. And so I'm very concerned with the aesthetics of the place. And so, yeah, reinventing myself, those things are all fun things to do, but they were not necessarily going to serve mankind or something, as well as producing my own food and teaching others to do it and so on. So I've been very happy to invent myself. I feel like I get all the fulfilling feeling that I would if I were the executive of some big corporation with all kinds of resources to manage and stuff like that. I am. I do get to do that.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to watch shit grow. You know, I almost enjoy it more than eating it in some ways. Well, so, you know, we're approaching an hour, just a little over an hour. I try to start winding down at this point. I'm just wondering, I mean, granted, it could go on for 6 hours, but I'm sure you know, have some chips to eat. In what we've already discussed, is there anything you feel like we've missed out on that, you know, to the young budding, you know, farmer out there
I think, Tim, that we've done a pretty good job. I should say you've done a pretty good job at hitting the bases. And of course, as everyone can see, I talk. Fast and loud and sometimes too much for people to follow. But we have covered an awful lot of ground. There is so much ground to cover. No, you say another 6 hours? No, another 6 days. This program could go on for 6 years. I mean, there's so much to be covered that there's no way.
Well, hey, you know what?
I'm satisfied if you are.
You know what? Then that's fine. I have some work to do in the yard. I'm just going to leave this recording. You can just keep talking.
Does it matter if I'm picking chips out of my teeth while I'm doing it?
It's fine. I'll hire an Uber to bring you some coffee.
All seriousness aside, you or I, either one of us, might come up with some ideas. Maybe as you finish reading the book, or I don't know if you ever look at my articles in the Mafka newspaper. I do every quarter. I have an article in there.
I definitely. I read your review of Medlar, and
I mentioned that because there's some of these things could lend themselves into a whole other blog. You know, we could go off in a direction on any one of these. And I guess all I'm saying is I'm open to it. If you come up with some idea from what I've got, or if I think of something I can like, I'm not likely to, I guess I'm going so many directions, but you might see something that, yeah, why don't we do that again someday and go into more detail and pick Will's brain on that.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, here's my last question. Have you ever thought about acorn tofu? That was like my $1 million main idea.
My goodness. I have no idea.
Is it possible?
I don't know if it would work or not. I'm not very much into tofu itself, because it is such a refined food. You take the fiber out, and you have a very high protein, high fat food. And to me, it tastes like hard-boiled egg white. If I'm trying to make something I want, like potato salad, that I'd love to have some hard-boiled eggs in, then tofu is cool for it. My favorite soy food by far is tempeh.
Yeah, is there an acorn tempeh-ish kind of thing?
Exactly. And what I know from some other people, tempeh can be made, at least from other legumes, And I think even some grains, I don't doubt at all it would work. I've had chickpea tempeh. In fact, I'm planning on making some. Fava bean tempeh, those can be real. Chickpea tempeh is almost as good, if not better, than soy-based tempeh. So I think the idea of acorns, quite possibly.
Okay, well, this is my last, and this is a personal question. If you have acidic soil, let's say somebody has a backyard and half of it is like a wet, acidic soil, would you like amend that heavily before planting staple crops in it, or do you think
you've got right there a whole other blog? We will right now, you and me, we will go into it a little bit, but there is so much to be done about that. So how to change not only fertility but pH without cake mix gardening would say add so many tons of lime per acre, okay? And you can do that. You can add tons per acre, and it'll raise the pH a few tenths of a point, and it'll drop back down again soon. Next year, you might have to do it again. There are other things you can do that do not require you putting anything at all in the soil. And just for example, one thing, look at what makes the pH so low to begin with. And one of the examples I always give of a kind of a archetypal acidic piece of ground that's in the shade of, let's say, a row of poplar trees. It's shaded, so it doesn't get a lot of sun. It's shade most of the time. It gets the tree roots and those, and the leaves blow down there every year, and it doesn't have a good drainage. It's just a little low, so water tends to sit in there while before draining off, especially in the spring. And those leaves that land on there, because they are overly wet, you know, sodden, they don't break down very well. It's an almost anaerobic situation. That soil is going to be as acidic as a green persimmon, and anything you do to add to it is going to temporarily help, temporarily putting, like, any kind of adding anything on. Well, excuse me, that's an ease. So let's say instead of adding something, let's say we do something. Okay, first of all, let's drain that piece. Put maybe a ditch around that, if that's part of your garden. Put a drain around it so it becomes, in essence, a big raised bed. Okay, so the water has some place to go. You lower the ground table, say 6 inches or something, the water table. That itself is huge. Now let's say you disturb that soil, especially if it's packed, if it's clay or whatever, but break it up. So forget you're a permaculturalist. At least once, disturb that soil. Now, sunlight can, and also maybe get rid of those trees. Cut those trees down. Use them for firewood, let's say. Instead of letting those leaves pile, shred those leaves and compost them. Burn that firewood and either chip some of that brush or the firewood, take the ashes from it. Ashes, which are six times more valuable than the lime in terms of their pH effect. You're adding something, but not something that was mined hundreds of miles away, something that was just mined like from 50 feet away. And but then, moreover, the wood ashes will have all the whole spectrum of trace minerals in them, which you're basically lime, aside from the pH, you're only adding calcium. So you do all those things. So now the air can start getting in, because cold fungal soils are acidic. Warm aerobic soils are more alkaline. So it's simply breaking up the soil, forking it up, letting the air get in there, letting it dry out. That itself, plus letting all that accumulation of watered up, half rotten but not enough rotten leaves, they start breaking. They now turn into compost. All of those things will all work together. Creating the drainage, letting air in, removing the shade, letting sunlight. UV is very, very alkaline encouraging. It'll destroy the fungal effect, which is causing a low pH. All of those things collectively will have a more or less permanent pH raising effect on them. The effect from those things will last for years, and if anything, keep improving.
That's awesome. Yeah, but I mean, do you find that crops like whatever quote-unquote new world crops, do you find that they don't mind acidic soil so much, like corn or
relatively you that's a really important thing you're nailing there. Relatively speaking, the new world crops do tend to be more acid tolerant, if not actually acid loving, which potatoes are, because again, that's the thing, they evolved in tropical soils which were warm but were, you know, when you slash and burn, yeah, you've got the minerals which will make, from the burning of the wood, which will make it alkaline, but there are soils which are naturally somewhat more wetter fungal soils. They will tend to be somewhat more acidic than the old world soils, which are constantly disrupted, plowed up and so on. And also, typically your old world soils tend to have been former grassland soil, at least when agriculture started in Eastern Europe and the Russian steppes and so on. These were grassland soils, like when you plow up pasture, you know, prairie soils in Nebraska or Kansas or whatever, they do go to an alkaline. They're alkaline to begin with, and they'll tend to go more alkaline. Whereas in New England, I mean, they will they were acidic, and they will tend to, in some cases, become more acidic, except insofar as the stuff starts breaking down, just as the breaking down of the pine needles or the oak leaves or whatever, and the air getting to them will make them more alkaline. But as a general rule, you're right. The old-world crops will tend to be more alkali-tolerant and, in fact, demanding than the old-world crops. It's not quite as straightforward as that, but insofar as one can make allowance for it, one can.
Well,
ideally, you'd like to have your garden so you can rotate everything around. You don't want to have to always have a new crop in this part of the garden, and you'd like to rotate them around, and one can. They're fairly tolerant of each other. Either one will do well in either situation. If you get the soil so it's slightly acidic, which lots of humus will do, good organic soil would be, I can't remember what they say, but, you know, a slightly acidic. And more important than that, a lot of humus will have a buffering effect on the soil. So even if your soil is a little bit too acidic, your plants won't mind it. That's what the buffers do. They'll make it effectively not so acidic, even though the actual pH may change, not much.
That's awesome. Yeah, again, like that was because Aaron Parker just came over here to whatever consult on my land, and he was like, well, when you talk to Will, you should ask him about New World versus Old World crops. So that wasn't my question. That was something Aaron had told me to
And it is true. Yeah, and it is true. If you have soil which is naturally acidic and everything you do to it doesn't seem to, it's going to stay acidic, then you might want to put more attention to potatoes. And unfortunately, they and blueberries are about the only main crops which really, really require, in fact, rather acidic soil. And so since you want to grow lots of different things, then, yeah, you have to do some things so you can move things around.
But blueberries are the best fruit, so wouldn't be too mad about that.
They're very high on my list. They're very, very I love my lots of them.
Well, again, that was like my little bonus selfish question for me personally. So do you I always like to ask my guests before we wind up, like, do you have any books that you recommend if people are interested in, you know, what you have to talk about? It doesn't have to be a farming book. It can be anything.
Well, first, more than anything else, of course, I recommend my own books, obviously. But no, there are several books that I've gotten a lot about over the years, and some of them are not that easy to come by. But one of my favorites has been Farmers of 40 Centuries. I believe it's in print now, but it was written way back around 1910 or something like that by a guy who was actually the sort of the equivalent of the head of the U.S., what today is the USDA. An establishment type of agricultural type. But these were very different times, and he went on this extended tour of Korea, Japan, and China, and for months, I believe it was, many, many weeks, and made some very astute observations. He missed some things really, really. He was really obtuse in not noticing when he was traveling in China that there was a lot of discontent, that he was there during the beginning of the end of the Manchu dynasty. And there was some like cataclysmic change. He didn't seem to notice that. But he did notice that the traditional ways that people did with agriculture and comments, and a lot of them are very, very sustainable, very Asparian, very, you know, very relevant to the things we're talking about. That's a really good book. One that I've got a lot of inspiration from, and it's not gardening at all per se, it's Craftsman of Necessity. And I've got a lot of ideas from that about, oh, making living hedges, living fences. And I learned from that how to make your own wheels, for example, with your own firewood from your own. Incidentally, there's a book idea that I haven't started yet, but that my publisher is eager for me to do. I ran the idea by them about the time I was finishing up on my other book. The idea of a book that I tentatively entitled Subsistence Forestry, on using, if you have a woodlot, not just getting you know, firewood and commercial, you know, saw logs and pulp and stuff from it, and even beyond forest stuff, even beyond rainmill chips and leaves, but also things like, you know, make my own axe handles and tools and even carts, wheelbarrows and things. Making your own lumber for, like, with it, like, anytime I need a beam for a barn or building or something like that, I don't take a log and haul it out, yard it out, and send it to the sawmill and so on. I make it right where it is in the woods. I'll sell it there. I take my chainsaw and my chalk line. I'll go in there and spend an hour or two and drag out a piece of lumber all ready to use. If I need the sills of my house are all 10 by 10 spruce beams, big, huge things. If I tried to, where I cut them way down in the woods, I couldn't even get at them with a tractor. They were in the bottom of this deep ravine. And even if I had brought them out, I would have spent a lot of money to get a truck to load them up, haul them to the sawmill, and then pay a lot for the sawing, because the sawmill charges you so much per board foot, not how many cuts. They would have basically made four cuts, and I would have been paying, you know, hundreds of dollars per thing. Whereas I went in there with a couple dollars worth of gasoline and made these things right in place, was able to drag them out with the tractor without loading. They didn't have to go anywhere. All of the beams in my house. So that's the kind of thing that book will probably contain, a lot of that. And publishers eager for me to do it, but I'm not ready to do it yet. But anyway, a lot of the ideas in it were inspired by that one I mentioned, The Craftsman of Necessity.
That sounds great.
Look it up online. You can just see what it's about. You see a review of it. There are some others offhand. I can't. There was one of Green Manures, and I can't think offhand of the guy that wrote it. Again, way back in the early 1900s. That's not the whole name, but there's something more to it. And I got a lot of very, very radical ideas came out of it.
That's great. It's always it's like I try not to ask people the same questions, but it's always like, I feel like, you know, if you're nerding out on a nerdy podcast, you might as well get some recommendations at the end, you know?
Well, maybe you're asking the same questions, but you're not asking me. This is the first time you ask me those questions. Right. You may get tired. You may get bored of asking the same question, but you're not going to get the same answer. And it's the first time you've asked me that question. Anyway.
yeah. That's my only generic question, though. I try not to inform you. Like, well. And if people want to follow your work, what's the best way to track you?
Feel free. I'm very promiscuous with my email address. It's as you know, it's wabonsall@gmail.com. People are welcome to contact me by that. I probably won't bother with a telephone, but
no, you don't want to give out your phone number.
Well, I mean, I do that rather freely when I'm speaking to groups and so forth. But it's actually more effective for me and for them if they, you know, the email, they can anytime they want to. It doesn't matter if I'm not home; I'll see it. So.
That's awesome. Well, I really like this book. Really inspired me. Like just your description of peas in the book was like made me want to grow peas because I'd never grown peas before.
Oh my goodness! Oh yeah.
And yeah, and so I'm
doing potatoes. Tim, you got to do potatoes too. I mean, they're not that hard to grow. If you don't have much space, that may be limiting. But the potatoes you can grow, like one of the main varieties I grow, Daisy Gold. There's no potato you can buy that's like it. You can get. Some of those German butterball and some of those, it's a yellow flesh. This is one of the best of them, flavor wise and production wise and everything. Even if I guess that one of the points I was making before is there's some crops that the crop, like sweet corn, you know. You can buy sweet corn cheap and you can grow it, maybe not. But can you get that particular variety? The variety of sweet corn is an old Maine cannon corn, which is commercially extinct now. And it's outrageous tasting, it's more corny flavor, any of these new sugar enhanced corn. Again, it's the whole thing, the big motivation behind gardening, aside from saving money and self-sufficiency and all that, is you can get this stuff yourself so much tastier. So something else that someone, again, Bill Gates can't afford it because he can't even find it. Doesn't even know it exists. He's missing out. You and I don't have to.
Yeah, you and I don't have to because I ordered, I think, 20 pounds of that potato from Mofka. So...
What kind did you get? What variety was it?
The Daisy, the gold. What is it? The Gold Daisy. What
are you telling? You said they're selling Daisy Gold. You saying who? Fedco.
Yeah, Fedco. I went to the Fedco.
I've recommended it to them for years, and I said they're finally offering it. Wow! I'm glad to know that.
It's got your name on it.
Yeah, well, it should. Right. I'm the one. I mean, it was bred by somebody from Holland, I think, originally. But I've been the number one person promoting that one in this country. And there's a whole bunch of others. Like one of the most popular ones that those guys have been selling. It's a very good one. Is begins with C and I'm having a senior moment here. Escapes me. It's a very popular variety and a very excellent one. And I pointed out to them another variety I've got, which is almost identical, but I thought was a little better keeping. Most of the people growing this stuff, market gardeners and stuff, they're selling it. They don't care about long-term storage. But what I like a lot better it's almost there. I can't quite get it. Anyway, a variety I've got is called Granola. It's a German variety. And it's very much like this. Damn it. Anyway, it's very much like this, almost identical, except it's slightly better keeping. But then, since then, I've got into Daisy Gold. I planted Daisy Gold quite late in the year and still got a big bumper crop. In fact, if you're going to grow this for your own use, here's a tip for you that you got seed from them. Plant them a little close together, maybe at most a foot, maybe 10 inches apart, because it's kind of like Green Mountain that way. They'll tend to overgrow and then get a lot of hollow heart.
Uh-huh.
So crowd it a little bit, and it won't hurt to plant some of them a little late. Maybe only a few early to get your early potatoes. But your main crop, you might want to wait until maybe June or the middle of June before you plant them. You'll still get a big yield of big potatoes, but less likely to get hollow heart, or cracking and splitting with it.
That's great. Yeah, but I'm looking at the Fedco seed site. Extraordinaire Will Bonzel plants Daisy Gold as his main potato variety with various others as backups. So, yeah, I ordered a bunch of those. So, yeah, great. So if I plant that in June, I'll get a nice crop, huh?
You should. I had a piece of garden once, a bed in the garden that nothing came up in, and I decided to bid it lately. I'm going to put in some Daisy Gold. What the hell? And it was into July, I think. It was quite late. And I planted that because I knew it was fairly early, very vigorous, quick growing. And it did. I got almost a full crop. There were most of my potatoes were totally full size. A few were a little small. So, yeah, and that means that's short of a season that you're picking bugs and so on, too, you know, being able to plant it later.
That's great.
It's kind of funny. Both Fedco and especially my publisher, these guys are doing everything they can to make Will Bonzel a household name. It's so weird. When first doing the book, and the publisher, I hate the title, by the way, Will Bonzel something essential.
It's
the only thing I like is the word radical is the only thing I like about that makes any sense. And I said the original title was Gardens Without Borders. And I spent 3 years writing the book with that title. And when it finally came up, the publisher said, yeah, it's catchy, but we think we need something different because people won't know what you're getting at. And she was right. And I said, well, as soon as they read the first paragraph, it'll make it clear what it is. But that's too late. They're standing there in the aisle at Barnes & Noble looking at it. They're not even going to open it until they see something. So okay, I agreed with that. But then they came up with Will Bonzel's Essential Guide to blah, 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 you know, and too long and too awkward. And I said, Will Bonzel, you know, it's not like that doesn't tell them anything. Will Bonzel is not a household name. We said, well, with us it is. They think in northern New England it is. And they said, anyway, it's going to be. So they're doing their can to make me a celebrity, so.
Well, hey, I'm trying to. I'm helping out, man. I'm doing my part.
Yeah, right. Okay. I can blame all of you guys.
Awesome.
Well, if it ends up giving me something I can take to the bank, that would be nice. Otherwise, it's just a pain in the ass. You have to wear sunglasses everywhere you go. You know? have security, armed security following you.
Yeah. A lot of Will Bonzel groupies up there in Belfast, huh?
Right.
Awesome. Well, hey, I really appreciate the work you do. It's really inspiring. I enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for coming on. And, you know, unfortunately, I'm having a baby around the time of Common Ground, so I won't be up there, but I'll keep my eye.
You're looking at it the wrong way. You're looking at it the wrong way. My wife does this all the time. You're looking at the glass half empty, so the glass is half full. You're having a baby, okay? Regardless of when it is, okay? Yeah, it's how inconvenient the fair happens at the same time, but the glass is half full. You're having a baby. That's fantastic.
Oh, yeah, I'm excited.
Well,
anyway.
Next year and the year after, when your baby is a little bigger, the fair will be even more and better to take your baby to see. It'll be greater.
I look forward to meeting you someday. So,
sure enough.
I'll catch you around, brother.
Okay, take care. Bye-bye.
Total lack of constraint appealed to me as a concept, a motto. Perhaps I never dreamed of anything more than a different system of constraint.
Shopping, but we ain't spending. We just taking all the things we need and so many things that we don't need will lead to ruins. From McDonald's to McLuhan,
Playing Lord of the Flies, the dead world's in our eyes, in the mind of a demographic time bomb. Whose time has come? Most likely too late. While the DJ played a stupid song of repeat. This blood on the dance floor could be ours, or it could be theirs. Bounces beware. We all wrap the core floor coffins, and it's about time we heat up more than the air.
And we'll be dancing to the beat of the end of the world.